The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bazong.
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 Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong. Bazong.
This is Bazong, the Bizarre and Weird Fiction Podcast with me, your host, Mr. Frank. Zongers, welcome back to the big show once again. Of course, you're joining us because you love the bizarre and weird fiction, and Bazong is dedicated to bringing you the best of the best and maybe the mediocre of the mediocre and the bottom of the barrel, as it were, in bizarre and weird fiction. So thank you, as always, for joining us this week. And of course, Bazong can't do what Bazong does without our fine sponsors. I am, of course, talking about the fine folks at Subculture Corsets and Clothing. I'm sure you've heard us talk about how much we love Subculture Corsets and Clothing. That word is so weird. It's just me, Mr. Frank. I am sure you've heard me talk about how much I love Subculture Corsets and Clothing. Sure, they've got great rockabilly, alternative, and pinup clothing, but they have so much more. Check them out at subculturecorsets.com and follow them on Facebook at facebook.com/subculturecorsets. Or go on Twitter. Are you a Twitterer? A tweeter? Go follow them on Twitter at @SC_corsets. And just Google Subculture Corsets and you'll see all their social media presences. Follow them and be sure to visit subculturecorsets.com. And make sure when you go and shop at subculturecorsets.com that you use the discount code Bazong for a 10% discount off your entire order. Not just one product, not like the least expensive thing in your cart. The entire cart is 10% off. So load that cart up, because the more you buy, the more you will save, Zongers. That's subculturecorsets.com, or visit their store in the Jacksonville, Florida area. They're just off I-95 at the Avenues Mall. Subculturecorsets.com. Thank you, Subculture, for helping Bazong be a thing. And a thing we have this week on the Bazong show is a guest that, man, he has been highly requested for quite some time. And it's not that I've been avoiding him, but it just seems like lately he's got, you know, stuff going on. So I decided it's time to reach out to our guest this week, the one and only Mr. John Conrath. He's been around the scene for a long time. He is, as he put it, and I've seen this term used a lot lately, he considers himself bizarro adjacent. I like that term, and it probably applies to so many guests we have on the show. Bizarro is a particular thing, but there's people who exist along the sidelines. They run perpendicular and parallel to, not perpendicular, they definitely run parallel to bizarro. They're close enough, but not quite on board. But yet they love being part of the community. They love actual intense bizarro stuff, so their work may not quite qualify. I know a guy like that. So Mr. John Conrath calls himself Bizarro Adjacent, and he's got a lot of cool stuff going on, including a new-ish podcast, The Concast. He's doing cool stuff over there. So we're going to talk to John about all that stuff, his podcast, his publishing company, and, of course, his long, long history in publishing. And we're going to start that all right now on the Bazong interview of Mr. John Conrath. Well, give us the gong. I'd like to welcome to Bazong this week a gentleman who has been highly requested for like the longest time ever. And I'm happy to finally be getting him on the show. I'd like to welcome the one, the only, Mr. John Conrath to Bazong. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to talk to you out in Jersey there.
Yes. Home, New Jersey, the home of Bazong. It's the home of all kinds of weird things, so we might as well do Bazong here as well. Like I said, A lot of people have been asking for you. You're like a figure that's been around in the bizarro scene forever. But, I mean, you know, I kind of look at your body of work. Do you consider yourself bizarro, John?
No, not really. I'm kind of bizarro adjacent, I guess you'd say. Real estate term. No, it's I consider myself an absurdist writer. And, I've got a lot of friends that are in the bizarro world. And, I've done some work with, I guess, what you'd consider bizarro presses. And I've done that. But I think I'm a little not really part of the club, not really, I do a little bit different of stuff. I think my influences are maybe a little different. But lots of friends and conspirators over on that side.
Exactly. I mean, you first came on my radar when you were working with Rooster Republic Press, and you didn't. That's where I sort of said, like, everybody's like into this guy and talking about him, and you're all over the scene, but your stuff isn't readily identified with bizarre. You've been self-publishing since the year 2000, basically, I think, is when you started. So I guess when you started publishing, it was all pre-bizarro for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when my first book, I did a print on demand by myself in 2000, and my first book was just straight fiction. Coming of age story of college. It was a book I probably should have thrown in a fireplace, but I printed it anyway. And then I started to get into more weird stuff. And it was really not until my second book, Rumored to Exist, came out in 2002 that I, went whole hog with that kind of stuff. And bizarro, I don't know what year you consider bizarro, like when the manifesto was written or whatever, but it seems like it was, I don't know, 05, 06, something like that. I don't know.
It sounds pretty accurate. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd read a couple of those. I read a couple of books, and I kind of was watching it, but I was pretty far along by then, and I was already, doing my own thing. And, I've been self-publishing the whole time, and I was kind of on the fence of, should I be looking at other publishers, or should I just keep doing what I'm doing? And I just kept motoring on with what I was doing, so... kept at that. But like I said, met a lot of people that were into it and, talked to them and then Facebook came up and I, hung out with people there a lot and all that stuff. But yeah, so it goes back. It's been an interesting trip.
I mean, you're self-publishing in a time when it was insanity to do. Like you said, print on demand. I mean, that was a highly frowned upon thing. What drove you to jump into self-publishing way back then when it was really like a bad word to say self-publish?
Well, when I started in the zine world. I started writing for heavy metal zines and stuff. And this was, 10 years before that. And so I was familiar with the DIY world, except back then it was, going to Kinko's and stapling stuff yourself and stuffing it in envelopes and all that. And at the time I was writing in the early 90s, I just kind of thought, well, when this gets done, when I get a book, I'll just find a publisher. I'll go to some big publisher or a midlist. And I mean, I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. But I just wrote to kind of get that done. And then when POD first came on the scene in the late 90s, I thought, oh, this is like a zine, except I don't have to staple and mail a shit. I can just get them to, publish it. And it goes on Amazon. And, that's fine. That's like a step above what I was doing with, zines and e-zines online and websites. It just seemed like a simple solution. And back then in 2000, nobody was talking about self-publishing. I mean, the Kindle wasn't out yet. And, there were people that were just, they didn't know. I mean, they were barely even talking about the impact of Amazon at that point. I mean, that was still, we were just a couple years in on that. So, it was, people were still like, yeah, brick and mortar and the big six or however many it was back then. So it was all completely under the radar, but it seemed like a perfect fit for me. And I just wanted those books to be on the shelf and wanted a nice copy in my hand that I didn't have to collate myself.
Now, the other thing, I mean, back then in that print on demand, well, was it print on demand? I know there was like when you were self-publishing or, you know, God forbid, vanity publishing, there was a big monetary investment, was there not? Or were you more into when print on demand started?
Well, that's the thing, too, was because when I was looking in the late 90s, I kind of thought, well, I'll go to one of these places where you can print, you know, 500 books. Like those places that drop print stuff and then, you know, you get a giant crate of books and then it's your deal. You got to set up a web page and take PayPal and sell it yourself. Or you got to schlep all these books to different bookstores and do consignment. And when POD started, I started with iUniverse. It basically didn't cost anything to set up your stuff there. I think the first book that I did with them, I think it was you paid like $100, but they gave you 5 books back or something like that. But then after that, they you could start for free pretty much. They would design the book and the cover for you, and they would just put it out. Their big thing then was like, well, you can do it for free, but we can edit it for you or do a better cover or do like some kind of marketing package where you can pay, you know, $500 or whatever and get us to write a fake review for you or whatever. But it was much better than the idea of, you know, paying a couple grand up front to get these books printed and sit in my garage for the rest of my life. And, you know, so I thought, yeah, I'll go for that. Definitely.
Now, yeah, I mean, I guess you had a sort of readership built up doing the zines, but when you were doing these print-on-demand books, how did they sell? Did you have already basically established sales when you going into it? Like, you knew how much to order, or was it like the Wild West? It was a whole new frontier for you.
It was a new frontier, and the thing is, back then with POD was you didn't order anything. The way that iUniverse and those other things work is they have this special machine that they just put a PDF and a TIFF cover in, and they can spit out just one book. Right. So they're not printing any up front. They're just listing you on Amazon. And when somebody orders it, this machine spits out a book and mails it to the person. Mm-hmm. So there was no upfront investment. There was nothing. I was just putting the stuff out there. And at first, from the zines and stuff and from just friends from college and all that kind of stuff, you know, I had a small readership, and I was back then it was just the Wild West. I mean, this was pre-MySpace, pre-Facebook, pre-everything. So, you know, it's like I had a mailing list. I've had a blog for I just hit 20 years on it. I've been blogging since way back. And I think from that, I had stuff, you know, people following me from that and finding me back when you could actually Google stuff and find it. And you know, I never had big sales from it, but, the one thing back then was the market was not as diluted as it was now. So if you had, there weren't that many people self-publishing or publishing in general. So it was a little bit easier to get, some sales out of it. Like if I look, my sales are like a big bell curve. And I think in the early days I had a lot more sales. And then as everybody jumped on and the Kindle came on, it became more of a struggle, to really get myself out there and everything. But, yeah, it was a hustle back then. You know, there was some readings and there was some little stuff like that. And I've always tried to do a lot of stuff through the mail, you know, mailing zines and mailing other junk to people just to keep them interested. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's cool. I mean, you were there at the beginning of like the digital publishing revolution. You know, that's what, circa 2007, 2008. How did that change anything for you? I mean, you said maybe it was harder because things all of a sudden get diluted, but a lot of writers I know back then when they were already in position, already had digital books up when that whole Kindle thing and Nook exploded, they're doing well nowadays. A lot of them were able to, you know, turn writing into a career for themselves just because they were positioned at that point. Did you have that similar effect when the whole market blew up and digitally?
No, and I think part of it was I part of it is I write weird stuff that's just not going to attract. I mean, I'm not writing detective stories. I'm not writing romance. And I think the reason the Kindle really broke was because of that. I think people that were reading like Harlequin type stuff that, you know, they read it and then they immediately go back on the Kindle and buy the next one in the series or buy whatever. I think that's one of those things that really, you know, made the Kindle go from like a little kind of niche device into something that, you know, everybody knows about, which is cool as far as, you know, getting more Kindles into people's hands and getting more, you know, money into, you know, getting the Kindle apps developed and everything like that. I mean, that groundswell, I think, helps all of us, even if you don't read romance, which I definitely don't. But yeah, I think I even though I was self-publishing, I was maybe a little bit late into getting into Kindle stuff. I think my first book on the Kindle I didn't do until 2010. And then I went backwards and, you know, tried to convert all of my old books and get them into digital format. So I was maybe a little bit late in the game in doing that. And I don't think that I necessarily marketed myself as like I don't really think in terms of like, you know, writing series of books, like, you know, some serious sci-fi people are really into kind of gaming that and, you know, writing part nine of, you know, some character and really locking people in and kind of doing the Hugh Howey model of, you know, getting writing page turners and stuff like that. And I never really did that. So it didn't have as big of an impact for me, but, I did notice, I mean, my Kindle sales were much higher than my print sales for a while. But I did have a certain amount of people that, you know, my followers that were like, I only read on paper. I'm only going to buy the paper stuff. I want to have it on my shelf, you know, and be able to hold it. So I've never done Kindle only stuff. I've always kept with the paper and I've tried to do a little extra stuff for people that do invest in the paper, like, you know, put an extra story at the end or do something like that. That's paper only. So, you know, those people get a little bit of something because they're spending more money for it.
So I guess you're really kind of the type of guy who prefers the physical paper books as opposed to the digital medium.
Oh yeah. I mean, if you look at my house, I'm, you know, I'm definitely going to die when the big one hits and all these bookshelves collapse. So, you know, there's that to look forward to, but yeah, I think, it depends on the kind of stuff, you know, like I said, if you're reading these page turner kind of things, and nothing against that. I mean, it's something, you know, I like to pick up a good detective book every once in a while, or, you know, flip through it. But if you're going to burn through something like that, it's way more convenient to do the Kindle. But for tech books or anything like that, it's definitely nice to have the search. But yeah, if I'm going to sit down with a nice William S. Burroughs book or something, I want the paper. I want to be able to, you know, really kind of go through the pages and, you know, hold up my hands while I'm reading it in bed or whatever. So I guess that's a little weird to talk about reading Burroughs in bed, but whatever.
Now, back in 2006, 2005, when you did first start reading some bizarre books, when that was starting to come up, did you read that stuff and sort of say, hey, this is kind of, I mean, obviously it's different, but did you identify your own writing with it, or did you really think it was something separate entirely from what you were doing?
Well, it was definitely different. I mean, I remember reading one of Melick's books back in, you know, 05, 06, something like that. And I was like, yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely not what I'm doing, but, you know, I was like, this is pretty cool. We'll see where that goes. But that was really like his pre, you know, bizarro kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was more longer form, you know, his earlier stuff. It seems like the bizarro stuff has definitely evolved into something else. And I was aware of, like, I knew Bradley Sands from, I published something of his in a zine way back, you know, 15 years ago or something. And so I was kind of aware of what was going on, but I never really read that much until I got involved with the Rooster Republic guys. And then started, you know, I was in collections of theirs, and then I started reading you know, the stuff that was in collections, and then, you know, reaching out to those writers and digging in. So, you know, guys like, you know, Don Noble stuff and Danger Slater is a big one. And it's interesting. Steve Lowe was another guy that, we actually grew up in the same town, didn't know each other then, but much later we met up when I was home for Christmas. But a lot of those guys aren't, I mean, Danger is a bizarro guy, but like Steve's stuff is not, he's published on Eraserhead and everything, but his stuff kind of weaves in and out too. So, and that's probably why I found it so interesting. It's like he can write different stuff, and but his stuff, his bizarro stuff is definitely bizarro. So, you know, I like that.
So what was it that attracted you to work with Rooster? Was it the writers they were working with at the time? You wanted to do that? What was it that made you kind of get on board with Rooster in particular?
It was actually through, this is in the beginning of 2012. It actually might have been at the end of 2011. But I was trying to publish a lot of short stuff, mostly online and, you know, in small journals. And I used to use Duotrope all the time, you know, list of markets and stuff. Mm-hmm. This was back when they were free and there were a lot more markets going, and there were a lot more online kind of weird, markets. So, I was always kind of playing that, you know, churn and burn game of, you know, going through and searching on anybody that had weird stuff going on. And Rooster came up and, you know, followed the Facebook page and looked. And this was when they were still called Bizarro Press. And it was before they had done anything. They were just, well, actually, Seamus had hit a couple of his books that he did self-published. And then I think Art Graham's first book had been out already. But it was right as they were decided to, okay, we're going to start a publishing house and we're going to do this collection and get a lot of people. So I saw their listing and cracked out a story, which is the first time I've ever done. I usually do it the other way around. I write stuff and then try to find a market, but I found this market and decided, hey, I want to get something into it. And, you know, wrote a short story and they picked it up and then, you know, kind of went from there. You know, waited on the thing to come out. And, you know, and then when it did, I started reading all these guys that were, in the first, episode or first issue and, you know, kind of going from there. So, and, you know, I followed a lot of the people. There's some people that it's like the, you know, you interact with them every day on Facebook and, you know, like Gabino Iglesias is a guy that, you know, I used to write back and forth with, or John McNee, or, you know, those guys that they're on Facebook every day and you see their memes or you read their links and stuff. And, you know, I just got involved that way of, you know, talking to people mm-hmm. that way. And yeah. And Seamus was a big, you know, a big, not influence, but, you know, he supported my stuff and he always liked it. And I was self-publishing my own books then. And that was really around 2010, I think I got a lot more serious about publishing more often, because I used to write a book and, you know, take a couple years and I'd get another one out. And that was the point where I went whole hog and I was trying to write at least a book a year. And for a while, I was writing two books a year. And he was always really supportive of it. And we were trying to get something out with them, a book, but we never, you know, got it lined up in the early 2010s. Mm-hmm. But we had talked about it. But then I, you know, I kept submitting to their collections. And I think I was in all but one of them just because of a timing thing. But yeah.
I gotta bring up the picture, because I think the really, I didn't have any real interaction with you back then, but you came into my psyche because there's a picture of you. I guess this is looking at it circa 1980s. You have a red Snoopy shirt on, you're in profile, you have big thick mutton chops, very thick black rim glasses. And Rooster, the people at Rooster were like making this picture a meme before memes were like an everyday thing. You got to tell me about this iconic picture of you, how it came to be, and what it's all about.
Okay, so here's the deal. I was in college. This is going way back. This was in, I think, 93. So I was in college. I grew a beard. I was bored, whatever. And then it's like I had to go home for Thanksgiving or something, had to shave off the beard and look presentable. So but I decided, hey, I'll just shave off a little bit, you know, take a couple pictures, shave off a little bit more, take a couple pictures, you know, kind of dumb thing to do. Mm-hmm. And this was also back in the days of film cameras, talking about analog. So there were just various pictures, and some of them were really stupid, you know, the pedistache and the lamb chops and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the picture sat forever. And then I don't know when, a few years ago, I scanned all of my negatives onto the computer, bought a scanner and did all that. And so I have this friend, Jessica Morris. She's been on my podcast and she's, you know, a longtime friend. And we always post stupid pictures back and forth in Messenger. And I sent her this picture. And it kind of became like a reaction picture back and forth between us. And she got the wise idea that she started one of these same picture of John Conrath every day things on Facebook.
Yeah.
And she started posting the picture that I sent her in confidence. And so anyway, and all of our friends followed it and kept reposting it. And then for whatever reason, it became, you know, we started doing Photoshops of it. And it was just the stupid meme that wouldn't die. And then it became, I mean, we did stickers and a lot of the Rooster people were involved with Danger Slater did a painting, like a watercolor painting of the picture, yes. Like this big painting. And they brought it. There was one of the shows in Dallas. I think it was Frightmare, one of the big shows. And a bunch of the Rooster people were there and they had this painting. And Erica instead is one of the people guilty of this too. And they were carrying this painting all around Dallas the whole weekend and taking pictures of it and posting it. So, you know, it's there at the book repository and I think it was at a strip club or something. And it's, you know, so I don't know. It just took off and it's still, we keep one upping it. I think I sent Jessica like a coffee mug and some, you know, a trucker hat and all this stuff for her wedding. I made these pins that show up everywhere. I can send you a couple, but, so anyway, yeah, that just went nuts for whatever reason. So yeah. And I'm into the memes and into the stupid stuff like that. I mean, that's, you know, kind of getting on Facebook and just shitposting stupid stuff like that is definitely a nice artistic outlet.
Did you ever find that people were basically discovering you because of the picture? Like they were checking out your books now because this picture became such a meme at the time?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely people that were outside of our circle of friends that were like, what the hell is this? And then, you know, I've had multiple people that said, I kept seeing, you know, whoever, Erica or somebody else posting this picture, what is it? And then they came through and I, you know, like I said, it was just kind of a silly joke, but then I ended up using it as my author photo for a couple of books. And, yeah, I did a zine last year that some of the various Photoshops and artwork was in, like just a short run thing. And yeah, it's took off. It's kind of a goofy legacy, but there you go.
Beautiful. We finally have the story of the picture after all these years. I want to further ask you, you were touching on stuff about, you know, possibly, I mean, you did get into the Tall Tales with Short Cocks, a couple of those anthologies and stuff, but, your main body of work, you continue to self-publish. Is that just on purpose? That's the only way you're really comfortable doing your stuff, or do you just not comfortable with going with a publisher?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me to think about. I mean, first of all, I work a lot with this guy, John Shepherd, and the two of us have kind of a pseudo book company called Paragraph Line Books. And it came out of a zine that I did that we ended up He self-publishes all of his books and I do mine, and we work with each other. I edit his stuff, he edits mine, that kind of thing. But he's had a couple of bad experiences with mainstream publishers. He had one of his most popular books that he printed with a publisher, and they just butchered it. They screwed it all up and put a stupid cover on it. And they have the rights forever, so he can never get it back. And it was a very personal book for him, so he's just kind of stuck. And that's just I wouldn't want to do that. I think I could publish with somebody if I really had total control over it. But then the flip side of that is, what do you get out of publishing with somebody else who's possibly using the same print on demand or Kindle technology as you? You know, if I went with, and I'm not saying Rooster's bad or anything like that, but let's say I went with some other press, and I would give up, you know, half of my money. Maybe they would edit it and do the cover, and that would save me some time. But would they do it the way I want to? You know, maybe, maybe not. It depends on how good they are and how much I trust them. But it's just, what do you get out of going with a publisher? And it's any deal. I mean, you get what you pay for. If you're giving up half of your sales or your book, are you getting enough value out of that? You know, marketing dollars. I mean, if you have a book on Eraserhead, you're going to be guaranteed a certain number of sales just from people that buy everything on Eraserhead, or, you know, you're going to be kind of set up to going to their shows or going to BizarroCon and getting sales out of that. But it's just, what is the cost benefit analysis? And for me and for the stuff I'm doing, I would rather just have control over it and keep, I mean, for me, it's not really about the money. I you know, if I break even, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for me, it's mostly the control and having the rights for it forever and being able to do exactly what I want and not having to delay and work with other people and stuff. I mean, I've got a day job. I do enough of that anyway, that I would rather have total control over it myself.
Well, I can certainly identify with that. I sort of have the same frame of mind when it comes to publishing my stuff. It's that complete control thing. That's sort of hard to want to give up. You know, especially like you said, when you're not making money hand over fist, it's like, why bother?
Yeah. And it's, you know, John and I with Paragraph Line Books have published a couple other people's stuff. And for us, it's more of a collective than a business thing. I mean, it's been handshake deals, and we've made deals with people where they've kept all the money. And we've just done the work just for the publicity's sake of, or, you know, just thinking they've got a really good book and we want to put it out and we want to see the light of day. And maybe they're not a person into self-publishing or whatever. So, I mean, I would rather say, look, you keep the money. I just want to see that book out there and I want to, you know, have a good cover on it and help you get the word out and stuff like that. Because ultimately for me, I don't really care about the money of it as much as just getting a good piece of work out there and, you know, getting it into people's hands and, you know, just doing the best I can with that.
I'm glad you brought up published, Paragraph Line Books, because it's something we want to talk about. So that really is just, something that you want to, you're enabling writers who, I guess, don't necessarily know how to get books out themselves, and it sounds like, you know, it's books you think deserve to be out, and not necessarily a business venture. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, and the book thing, we've only done I think two people right now, and the book thing is hard just because there's so much, you have to do so much to get a book out, especially a bigger book. And we've done a lot more, or I've worked with a lot of other writers, both in, we did an anthology series, we did 13 issues, and I worked with a lot of writers with that. And then we also did a lot of online stuff. We were publishing a couple stories a week and kind of having contests and paying people based on traffic. And through that, I met a lot of other writers, and that is the kind of stuff that I like to do. But I mean, it's so much work. having a journal like that online, sifting through all of the submission queues, and you know, and we weren't even doing editing that much on other people's stuff. Mm-hmm. Just the formatting of it and getting the website going and getting, you know, telling people every week and just keeping track of who's on first and what's going on. And I mean, it's a lot of work, especially when you're, you know, working 40 hours a week and you got a family and you got to, you know, you got to write your own stuff too. So yeah, but it's the books are a little bit harder, and we haven't done any other books in a little while, but it's definitely the kind of thing that I could see happening once we meet other writers that want to do stuff like that with. And me and John have been keeping busy with our own books. So, you know, we're both churning out one or two books a year, and, you know, that's, and I've supported him since I've met him, you know, going on 15 years ago, and he's always done great stuff. And he's very much out of the bizarro sphere as a whole. I mean, he started as an MFA guy, and he's kind of found his footing. He does more weird stuff, but he's got a lot of kind of science fiction background, a lot of, you know, kind of the page turner detective background. And he has a military background too. So, I always love his stuff, everything that he does.
Now, what are you doing, for yourself and Paragraph Line as far as marketing the books? Are you getting out to shows, doing signings and stuff like that? Or is it really all internet based?
I hate leaving the house. and, you know, it's funny, with signings and stuff, I don't mind meeting people and stuff like that when we're out. But, the funny thing about signings for me is I used to collect a lot of first editions and go to signings and try to get people, you know, get Nick Hornby to sign a book or whatever. And I think about the time that somebody first asked me to sign a book, I was like, okay, this is kind of bullshit. I was like, I'm done getting signatures, and, you know, it's kind of lost its meaning to me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we do a lot of stuff online. It waxes and wanes. Like, we were very heavy into doing blogging on other people's stuff and, you know, doing not only short stories, but just weird stuff and stuff under pseudonyms and short articles and all that kind of stuff, listicles, just whatever stupid stuff. Lately we've been podcasting, and that's been how we've been. And I don't know if that's a marketing thing or, you know, you tell me, but it's a lot more if we just want to be able to talk about writing and talk about what makes us tick and, you know, meet other writers and you know, maybe out of my sphere and, you know, talk to them about why they do what they do.
Yeah. Perfect segue there for the podcast you're doing, the Concast.
Yeah.
I got a chance to listen to several episodes, really dig it, as it's, I mean, you present people who, I guess they're just people, you know, and you want to present to the world there, and they're not necessarily any type of celebrity per se, but you listening to the interviews, I mean, you make everybody you interview sound definitely interesting. I really loved the last one you did with Andrea, and you were talking about the old, like in the college computer labs and using GopherNet and all that stuff, which is like,
I was
in that scene. I totally identify with that stuff.
Yeah, and that's a good example of, I mean, Andrea's a writer and, you know, has been for a long time. And she just finished her MFA at Warren Wilson. And I always want to talk to her. We talk for hours every time we get together. But about just whatever, about UFOs or about college or about books or whatever. I wanted to talk to her about, I didn't do an MFA, and I'm always curious to see why people go to school to write and what they got out of their experience and that kind of stuff. So I've talked to different people about that, or just their writing journey in general. And I think about half of our podcast is either John or my friend, Jessica Morris. I keep saying Jessica Morris, because I know it's Jessica Anschutz because she got married last year. Sorry, Jessica. But, so half of our podcasts are just talking about, our history, or, you know, we get into pop culture stuff. Like, we did a whole episode on concerts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But then I also like bringing in other people. Like, one of the first people was Jeff O'Brien, who has written, and he's another guy that is he bizarro or is he, you know, just, you know, writing about barbarians and stuff like that. Yeah. And, but he's definitely within that sphere of, you know, the bizarro world or, and he's a guy, I mean, this is a good example of, we've been Facebook buddies for years, but aside from shooting back and forth memes and, you know, ripping on each other or whatever, we've never really sat down and talked. So, you know, to have the chance to sit down and get him on the, you know, get him on the mic for an hour and just go back into his history and talking about his bands and, you know, talking about UFOs and talking about, which always seems to come up. It was just a great experience for that. And, you know, if some of my folks that have never heard of Jeff tune in and, you know, check out his books, that's great. If some of Jeff's folks listen to me and babbling on and decide, hey, I want to look him up, that's great too.
Yeah, I love I get to do that a lot of times with Bazong. It's the same thing. Talk to people who I have a lot of Facebook, social media interaction with, but until I actually approach them and to do the interview and have an actual, at least vocal conversation, if not face-to-face, those are kind of special because it is like two friends who've known each other forever, but have never actually connected in a real way almost. And
yeah,
it's fun to do that.
Yeah, the conversation is great. I think, you know, we're still pretty new at this. I started in July. I think we've recorded about a dozen of them. I think seven or eight of them are up already. We've been doing them every other week. Yeah, and it's great. I think we do a lot of them remotely just because people are all over. I think, you know, you're the same way. Mm-hmm. We're whatever, 3,000 miles apart right now. But I really love doing them in person. It's just hard as far as, you know, who's out here. And I live in the ghetto of Oakland. I, you know, getting people to come out here with their cars is always difficult. But yeah, I love talking to people like that. It's a great new thing for me. Although they've been around for 10 years, it's great to see everybody doing them now.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as marketing, you know, self-marketing, my experience, I don't know that it's really, I mean, it's not a huge marketing thing. There's certainly, I mean, people listen to this podcast, you know, week after week and know who I am, and I'm sure I've had book sales as a result, but it's not the driving force of any sort of marketing. And in fact, I think it's the people I interview who really get the benefit of being on the podcast, being marketed that way. I know I have a lot of listeners that always say, it's like, man, I'm buying everybody's book that you interview here. You're killing my wallet and all that stuff. So I think it's the other people that benefit, and which is why I started doing Bazong, is because I love the scene. I love the writers. I love talking shop with all the writers. It's sort of why I started the podcast, just because I love talking with people who are creative like that. And so, you know, it's I never started it to be a marketing tool. I guess it's sort of a byproduct of doing it, but it's not like a huge way to sell books for yourself. That's for sure.
And for me too, the podcast was I have a really bad nostalgic streak, and you know, we always talk about stuff from the 90s and all that kind of stuff. And I really wish I would have captured more back then. I mean, I got a couple boxes of zines and flyers and, you know, still got demo tapes and stuff like that. But I really want to capture this stuff because there was a movie about Howard Bruckner who he did a documentary about Burroughs in the late 70s, early 80s. And he captured a ton of that stuff. Mm-hmm. In like 8mm film and camcorder and audio stuff. And his, Howard Bruckner, passed away of AIDS in the 90s. And his, nephew has been trying to restore all of his stuff. And he just discovered this huge treasure trove of interviews with authors and stuff with Ginsberg and running around with the Ramones and the, you know, Lower East Side in 1979 on VHS tapes. And, you know, it's just so awesome. And I would like 20 years from now to just be able to dig out these MP3s and just be like, holy shit, this is so great to capture this stuff in time.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah.
I know I have boxes of things just put away in an attic or in a crawl space somewhere that I can't bring myself to get rid of because I know it's sort of archival, if nothing else. It's not just junk. There's sort of archival, you know, moments in time that are just tucked away in those boxes. And, you know, a couple times I'll bring them out. I'm like, oh, man, this is so cool. I used to do this stuff. Our friends, we used to, you know, be in high school and have guitars and we'd come home from school, crank up the amps and just hit record on a tape player and just wail away and make shit up on the spot. The dumbest crap, but I don't have those tapes anymore. That would be so fun to have and listen to that crazy shit.
Yeah, it's always so awesome to see that. Or when somebody, a friend, does pull out some of their old photos from the 90s and scans them and you're like, holy shit, look at those. Mm. Look when I used to have a normal BMI and, you know, those horrible glasses and whatever. But still, it's always interesting to see that stuff.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, it'd be a cool thing to actually, I don't know if you could turn it into a podcast. You'd probably have to do a YouTube thing. But if you had a lot of audio stuff, that'd be kind of a cool thing, a nostalgia type podcast. Because, you know, it was your experience, but everybody, you know, people assuming listen to you have lived through the 90s, the 80s, whatever, they're going to identify with that stuff somehow. I think it'd make for a cool podcast if you had that kind of treasure trove of stuff.
Yeah, and we did a podcast that it probably won't be out until December, but when John was out here for a week in July, and we marathon recorded a bunch of podcasts that we're slowly doing, but we did a whole, I think we just talked for like 90 minutes about the 90s. And yeah, so just kind of spoiler alert, we'll get that out there. But yeah, I still have some tapes of interviews. I used to work at a radio station. I used to interview a lot of like death metal guys and stuff like that in the 90s. And I know I have those tapes in storage. I know somewhere I have an interview with Pete Steele from Typo Negative that I did in 1992.
Nice.
And I don't even know what it sounds like. I don't even know if the tape is still, I mean, I try to play it and it disintegrates, but yeah, I want to see if I can get that digitized and restored somehow and put it on a podcast or throw it online or something.
Yeah, that's the stuff right there that would be so badass to hear something like that. A little time capsule stuff. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
We're coming to the end, but I have to touch on this because, you know, we had some bullet points of stuff we wanted to go over, and you brought up one that has, I mean, completely endeared me to you, and that is Mr. Chuck Tingle.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, I've lamented this type of stuff. I'm like, I don't get it. When I first seen it popping up, I'm like, this is insane. And then everybody did it because one guy made $1 million off of it. And it's just absurd that's even a thing, but it continues to this day. Chuck Tingle and his like, I call it bizarro erotica, for lack of a better term. And you brought up the fact that you have an unhealthy dislike of Chuck Tingle as well. You want to get into that?
Yeah, this is the point in the podcast where I lose everybody. But so here's my thing about it. When the Kindles came out and when people really started looking at this, there was a real tendency for people to figure out how to game it. And I think that there's a big race to the bottom because of this. I mean, you know, in the 90s or in whatever print books, people would write a 320 page book, spend a lot of time on it and do that. And I think once people realized, well, for the same price, I could write an 80 page book. And as long as it's got a good title and a good cover and people click buy, then I've made the same amount of money for a lot less effort. And I think, and then people kind of figured out of like, well, I could buy some fake reviews and that kind of games the Amazon system a little bit. And, you know, I could do a little bit shorter stuff, or I could just throw something together quickly. And it just becomes a race to the bottom where, everything is a 99 cent book or a $2.99 book. And a lot of the blame on that is the way that Amazon works and the way Amazon Unlimited works is that they're just kind of, I mean, one is they've killed the mid list. I mean, there's no mid list publishers anymore because, you know, why would you do it? Mm-hmm. when you can just churn out these little episodic things. And I think, and this is, a lot of people get mad at me for saying this, but the whole Chuck Tingle experiment is like just a weaponized version of that. I mean, it's just like when they took cocaine and decided we could make crack cocaine and sell it for way cheaper, and it has a lot less of a, you know, whatever. And it seems like he's come up with this idea of a really catchy title, you know, artwork that kind of goes with it. It's very timely. It's something he can crack out really fast, and that's it. And, you know, is that the same as, you know, a William Faulkner book? No, it's kind of not even a book as much as it is kind of a publicity stunt or, you know, I don't know, just a one line joke or something. And, you know, and that's fine if people are into it or whatever, but it's part of this race to the bottom thing where, you know, he did it, and then everybody else was like, well, how can I do it? How can I make $1 million off of it? And honestly, if you're in that mindset, I mean, just go sell vitamins or aluminum siding or something else. I mean, there's, you know, many other ways of, you know, you could sell homeopathic medicine online or something and make just as much money, and not have to, you know, kind of kill the book market. So I'm, you know, and like I said, I know a lot of people would be upset about that, and a lot of people find him funny, and, you know, that's fine, but it just kind of bugs me.
Yeah. I think the thing that rubbed me wrong about it on the outset was just the length of them. I mean, they're short stories at best, more times than not. And like you said, $2.99 for something I can open and be done reading in 5 minutes. And then on top of that, they're not vetted. Nobody's edited them. Obviously, part of the quote unquote charm of them is the terrible Photoshop covers and everything. And that turned me off big time. And even like, you know, when the real erotica books that come out, I mean, the same sort of thing. But I don't know. It was almost like, well, the point of them was something to, you know, be titillated by, and you know, all right, people are going to spend money on that, I guess, is absurd and appalling it is to me. And it was like, but these Chuck Tingle type books, like, they're not even meant to be like erotic or anything. They're just complete goofs. And it does look like a complete money grab and everything. And that's what turned it off for me. I mean, I've also, on the same token, I've interviewed a couple of the people who've done them, and I don't know. I get it. You know, it's not something I'd ever do, but it is, I mean, it's something 20 years down the line we're going to look back at and say that was a thing then, I guess, but it's definitely not going to be a thing I'll ever participate in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, I think it's like the disco of publishing. I mean, it's just the same way as we look back of, you know, people used to do these albums with artwork and gatefolds and spend half a year, you know, the Rolling Stones in some studio doing some awesome album. And then somebody was like, well, we could just do a thing where a guy's got an 808 drum machine and just, you know, pumps out this stuff for as cheap as possible. And it's a fad and it'll come and it'll go, but we'll cash in on it while the wave is high. And you look back on it and it's like, oh man, what happened to music? And you know, it's the same with writing of, you know, why should I spend a year writing a 300-page book when somebody will spend, you know, a couple hours throwing something together like that? And I still do it, and I still, you know, I'll keep going, but it is frustrating, and it's, you know, and am I jealous that he's making $1 million on it? Well, you know, I wouldn't mind having $1 million for doing something like that, but, you know, keep writing.
Yeah, that ain't going to be the way you're going to make the millions.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got a day job. I'm not making $1 million at it, but I'm, you know, probably making more than I could make pumping out something like that. So
yeah, that's true, too. Well, John Conrath, we've come to the end, and I like that we've left on that point of Chuck Tingle and the race to the bottom. But, you know, you can only go up from there, so why don't you tell everybody where they can go up and find your books that are much better than Chuck Tingle books?
Well, you can find me on Facebook. That's easy. But rumored.com, rumored.com, has been my website forever. And if you go there, I've been, like I said, I started blogging there 20 years ago and still doing it there. The podcast is there too. Theconcast.com, paragraphline.com. I've got stuff over there. But yeah, rumor.com is got everything, and it's not going away. I think when Facebook implodes and Twitter is outlawed and everything else, Rumored will still be there.
Yeah, rumored.com is awesome, and it's a rare, active, continually active author website. So, and like you said, anything that you do, podcast, publishing, and your books are all there in one hot spot.
Yeah, I had my 20th birthday there, and I actually looked back, and I think I have like 1.5 million words published there, and almost none of it's stories. It's all just day to day and essays and travel and everything else, opinions. And so, yeah, if you're really bored at work, dig into that.
And there's one of them time capsule archives there. You can go back 20 years and see. I can't even believe that websites are a thing for 20 years now. It's hard to wrap your mind around, but there, I mean, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right, John, thank you very much for joining us on Bazong this week. It has been a pleasure. Look forward to seeing more of your work out there in the future.
Great. Thanks for having me.
The one and only Mr. John Conrad Zonger is happy to have finally gotten him in the loop here on Bazong. Of course, man, I don't know if you aren't part of the Bizarro scene and don't know that John Conrad picture, that little awkward side shot with the decadent 80s mustache and a red Snoopy shirt. That thing has been circulated as a meme 1 million times over. Definitely sort of an underground iconic meme here in the Bizarro community. Of course, if you want to check out John Conrad's stuff, the one-stop shop is, as he said, rumored.com. That's R-U-M-O-R-E-D .com. There you can get his podcast. You can see all his books that he's published. And, of course, all the stuff he's working on with the Paragraph Line publishing company. He's also running concurrently to his own stuff. Another one of them multitasking. It seems pretty tireless in his work. And like I said, it's a very always up-to-date website. It's never neglected. There's always stuff going on. So 20 years celebrating a website like that, that's pretty incredible stuff. Check it out, rumored.com, for everything John Conrath. And Zongers, if you want everything Bizong, make sure you follow us on whatever platform it is that you follow us on. Should you listen on Stitcher, subscribe to us on Stitcher. And really, very importantly, if you're listening to us on iTunes, please, dear God, subscribe to us on iTunes. We had that little glitch a couple of weeks ago where the shows got dropped because somebody had to have a potty mouth. Not going to name any names. But somebody had to have a potty mouth, and they got delisted. All our shows on the Project Entertainment Network got delisted. We're back up. We're clean. We work blue now, or we don't work blue, however that works. But we're back on iTunes, so please make sure, if you were subscribed, that you're still subscribed. And if you aren't subscribed, just subscribe to us on iTunes, and you'll just get automatically when there's ever a new Bazong show every Monday here on the Project Entertainment Network. It'll be right there waiting for you, or whatever other platform it is that you follow us and listen to us on Bazong. Make sure you subscribe to us and rate us too, man. That'd be awesome. I don't say it enough, but if you listen to the podcast, just please drop a quick rating, a thumbs up, thumbs down. I know they run on Stitcher, iTunes, I guess is stars, and leave a review and stuff. All that stuff is really extra awesome, great. It's like the cheapest, easiest way you can help Bazong your appreciation for it, especially if you hate it. Like, give it one star and go, this podcast really stinks, and I'm never going to listen again until next week. That type of stuff. Any type of rating whatsoever is hugely important, not only for Bazong, but for the listeners of Bazong and potential listeners of Bazong. So I really appreciate your contributions in those areas. Please, Zongers. And with all that good gravy in mind, that's all we got for you this week. Make sure you go over to projectentertainmentnetwork.com. Visit the store page. You can get all your Bazong merchandise. Pillows now. Bazong pillow fights. Somehow I'm going to make this like a big event. Maybe like Bazong Pillow Con, where everybody buys a Bazong pillow and we meet up somewhere in Chicago in a hotel room, and we just have like an all-out bizarro bizong pillow fight. Wouldn't that be awesome? If you think that's awesome, please let me know right away on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at Bizong Podcast or at Bizong, wherever the fuck it is. We're on Twitter. Follow us there. Let me know you want a giant Bizong pillow fight in Chicago, and we'll make that happen somehow. Okay, Zongers, I've said enough. So now you're free to go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Every person's story has something to teach us. How others view life, how obstacles are overcome, how joy is felt, how fears are faced, how love is expressed. The Matters of Faith podcast explores individual stories of people's lives and how faith plays a part. It may not be your story, but it may help shape yours.
The Matters of Faith podcast with Jay Wilburn is on Project Entertainment Network.
Scribblers rest. Do you pop D20s like candy? Do you bleed D6s? Then Scribblers rest is your fix. Do some time with a crew of authors, artists, and other nefarious types. We have a case of dews in the fridge, and plenty of magic missiles to unload into your darkness. Slide us in your ear hole and let us work our magic. Feel our vibes every Thursday on the Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.